The way that you've told the story, it does make it feel like time stood still for you in what was a hugely profound day, which from what it looks like started off as somewhat of a regular day. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it was a day like every other day on a deployment, right? With a war going on. But, you know, it was so April 7th, 2003, at this point, our ground troops had pretty well pushed all the way towards Baghdad. And for us in the A-10 community, that meant we had moved forward to Baghdad as well, just in terms of where we were flying. Our normal mission set is we would take off from Kuwait, we'd fly all the way up to Baghdad, it's an hour in an A-10. We would air refuel, so fill up on gas, fuel, and then we would just wait. We would just wait for a tasking. Whatever was happening on the ground, we had a sense, but we didn't really know what we were going to be called to do. Unfortunately, on April 7th, there were clouds covering Baghdad, which was abnormal. Just as far as we could see, clouds covering all of Baghdad, and we weren't really sure we were going to be effective. And then we got a call, you know, crackle over the radio, and we get this call. And I very clearly remember hearing kind of the ground controller. I could hear like the stress in his voice. And he said, Yard 05, this is Advance 33. We're taking fire. We need immediate assistance. And, you know, hair in the back of my neck stands up. Adrenaline starts pumping because we know that lives are on the line. So we listen closely to, you know, his whole description of what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, we're proceeding directly to the target location, just hoping that we can find a hole in the clouds so we can get down below the weather. And I remember just kind of looking over at my flight lead at some point, and he had this like super confident, you know, very well and experienced in the airplane. I just watched him kind of roll inverted and then disappear down through the clouds to get below the weather. And then I just remember this like little bit of hesitation of like, this is it, right? Here we go. And because I don't want to screw it up, right? I mean, I looked down and found my own hole in the clouds. And as soon as I popped out down below the weather, I could see this massive firefight happening. There were bright flashes and smoke and tracers, and very surreal in many ways, because it is everything that we plan for and train for. But to see it and to see this firefight was something very different for me. We knew we had to get in quickly, so we made a couple passes, rockets and gun, trying to get to a target that for us was underneath a bridge over northern Baghdad. And then I just, you know, we had decided that we would just do a couple passes because not only is there a firefight happening back and forth across the river, but we start to see like puffs of gray and white smoke and bright flashes in the air. So now the enemy is shooting us at us too. And I set up for my last rocket pass. I do all my standard checks. I roll in. Everything's going normal. I pull off away from the ground, away from the threat, as we normally do, trying to climb up just to get altitude and airspeed back. And then I just hear this huge explosion at the back of the airplane. And I know immediately that I am hit. I mean, there's this bright red-orange fireball. The jet noses over and kind of, well, it does, completely points down at Baghdad below me. And I just kind of instinctively just, I pull back on the control stick and nothing happens. Like the jet does not respond. And I remember just looking down at Baghdad, ground is getting closer. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to eject. Like this is not, this is not what I had planned. And then training kicks in and I just quickly try to analyze the situation, figure out what's going on. I've got lights flashing at me. This whole caution panel on my side is lit up. And I remember looking and seeing these hydraulic lights and my hydraulic gauges were at zero, which hydraulics is how we can control the airplane.
Yeah, systems
hence empty. The reason that I'm plunging to the ground out of control.
Yep. It's extraordinary. And what was your altitude at the point where that started to happen? Because when we think about aircraft, particularly fighter aircraft, you know, the A-10 is quite specific to be able to get in quite low. It's very atypical. So where were you at about that point?
Yeah, I mean, we can operate at about 100 feet off the ground, you know, the 100 to 500 feet, depending upon how experienced we are. But normally we're up at like 20,000 feet-ish, you know. And I was at about 7,000 feet or so when this happened. So we had gone down low to shoot, now climbing back up, trying to get our energy back while also staying below the clouds. which unfortunately means that we're highlighted. I mean, if you're looking from the ground up at an airplane that is, you know, backlit from the clouds, very easy to see. But for us, that was the risk we were willing to take because these troops on the ground needed our help. But not a situation I ever thought that I would find myself in.
Extraordinary. And the A-10, for anyone who doesn't know, is built with extraordinary redundancy. So the systems, whilst all hydraulic fluid is gone, the system is not responding as possible. Something then happens to get you home. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how this aircraft is built to deal with such redundancy? And by the way, this was designed, I think, back in the 50s. Is that right? The airframe was sort of designed as...
The first airplanes came out in like 1978, 79, 80 are all the ones that we were flying. But I mean, you're right. It was built to take hits. I mean, it was designed specifically to support troops on the ground, knowing that we would potentially take hits while performing its mission. So even though I'm plunging to the ground, there's no hydraulics, I'm thinking about ejecting, I also know that I have this emergency backup system. It is a system that allows us to fly on cranks and cables, no hydraulics, but it's called manual reversion. And thankfully, it's just a switch that we flip. It's not something that we pre-flight plan. It's not something that we train in very often, but I flipped the switch. And thankfully, that airplane started to climb up and away from Baghdad. And it's what allowed me to get home safely. I mean, without that emergency backup system, I likely would have been flying a parachute down into central Baghdad, which I don't think would have gone very well.
No, not a great end of the day.
No, not at all.
There, you say, or you talk about this idea, there was about an hour or an hour plus flight home in order to get away from or out of enemy airspace back to friendly territory. And just getting home, the job wasn't quite done yet. You know, landing a plane in this mode is not something, as you said in the book, it's not something that is often trained for. And I'm sure there was teams far and wide, you know, really rooting for you to get home safely and to land this aircraft. What was that like on that last moment? I remember you talking about this idea of, you know, if you get to a point where you can't eject, it's there is this point of no return, essentially, to try and land that aircraft.
Yeah, it was that trip home was probably like the longest hour of my life, just trying to make a decision and feel good about the decision. And, you know, I knew that I could get back to friendly territory and eject if I needed to. I knew the rescue helicopters would be there for me. But ejecting wasn't something that I took lightly, you know, and I felt after an hour, I felt very comfortable flying this airplane. It was something that I hadn't trained to do, to land in manual reversion, but I at least knew of the stories of the pilots that had come before me. We had learned from their experiences some things to do differently. So I had all of that, you know, going on in my mind of all these things. But like you said, there was this awesome team, some that I knew about, some that I didn't know about, providing mutual support. I had these airplanes overhead providing cover for the hour-long flight home. The rescue helicopters, you know, our emergency response crews, like there's this whole team that's got my back. So yes, I'm in this airplane single seat flying by myself, but I have this entire team, including my wingman, right? Who is the most important person providing that mutual support. And, you know, he had my back the whole way. We bounced ideas off each other. He reassured me, you know, just knowing that this was a pretty terrifying situation. But to have somebody like that, to provide that mutual support, to be by my side, to have my back, to believe in me was huge for my confidence, for my belief in myself. And it was, you know, to me, when I look back on this mission, that's what stands out to me most. I mean, yes, I flew this airplane by myself, but I had a whole lot of people that were by my side providing that mutual support, helping me to ensure that I could get back safely. And even if things did not go well, they were there waiting. You know, no matter what, I would have this team, whether it was rescue helicopters, the emergency response crews, I had this whole team, you know, supporting me, which made a huge difference.
It's quite extraordinary. So the wheels hit the ground, you come to a rolling stop. I can only imagine the relief must have been extraordinary. there is. Congratulations over the radio from people who have been on looking on all of this. And in the context of being deployed, it's a very important day. And you now know that tomorrow is another day where everyone is still going to be doing their job. They're still going to be flying the sorties they've got to fly. In a deployment, there's often not a lot of time to reflect and think about everything that's gone on. And in such a massive day in your life, how did you have a chance to reflect on that? Or did it have to be sort of compartmentalized and you sort of wait for that to happen after you get home or maybe in the years to come? How was the time to sort of process all of that through? Because it's quite an extraordinary event.
Yeah. It was a little bit of both, I think. Obviously, after landing the airplane, there was just this like huge adrenaline high. I felt like, just it took me some time to come down from that. I didn't really talk about it much after I landed. I mean, certainly people asked me some questions, but I didn't really take the time to really think through or talk about it too much. I mean, we debriefed the mission itself, but kind of the personal concern and doubts of the fact that I came very close to dying, I didn't really come to grips with that. And I'll be honest, I compartmentalized most of it. Like I just tucked that away of like, I felt like I couldn't open it up right then because there was still a war going on. I still needed to be able to fly missions. But I did, the one thing I did that I think that was helpful was that night I journaled everything out. I just kind of wrote through the whole mission and kind of what I was thinking. And that allowed me enough space to decompress. And then the rest of it, I just kind of tucked away to deal with later once I got home from the deployment and had an opportunity to kind of talk with my husband, who is also an A-10 pilot. So,
yes,
share all those things, right? Having a partner in life that, he was essentially, my wingman, right? Somebody that he understood what I was going through. I could talk through it with him. And that was really helpful for us. And honestly, very helpful for our marriage as well, because this happened pretty early when we had been married. And it allowed us to have some very tough conversations about our priorities in life very early in our marriage. So I don't know. I look back on this mission and yes, was it terrifying? Yes. There were a lot of negatives and things that, life-changing really, but I learned so many lessons from it that, that ability to compartmentalize and move on, but also prioritize what's important to you in life. I guess in many ways I'm grateful for it.
It's extraordinary, Kim. I mean, and this, for this to happen so early in your career, it feels to me as an observer from the outside, it feels like you've paid that forward consistently all the way through your career to make sure that everything that was learned, everything that was absorbed, could be paid forward to all of the teams. And you spoke with great affection of Lieutenant Colonel Rick Turner, who was your lead in the air, side by side all the way through this experience. The Air Force, like the Army, where I'm from in Australia, we spend a lot of time getting to know each other through very arduous training. We spend a lot of time, experiencing things which allow us to develop a language and a culture that reinforces that really strong work ethic and the humor that comes with that and all the things that are really important to make, sometimes not so fun circumstances, ones that you can endure and actually frankly enjoy. When you think about that experience of that day and everything that happened subsequent, how did that reinforce your understanding of the importance of partnerships in such a high stakes environment, knowing that from your husband's point of view, in probably a one in a million circumstance where technically he would understand a lot of what you can say, in many cases, an at-home partner still has a distant understanding of what people do professionally. So that was a super unique circumstance. When it comes to that partnership mentality, knowing, and for those who don't understand, the crews that look after your aircraft, the crews that look after the airspace, you will sometimes know them quite intimately. In other cases, they're just a voice on the radio. How has your perspective on partnerships sort of evolved, I guess, from that day all the way through your very incredible military career?
Yeah, there's a couple things, right? I think one, you touched on it, is when you do hard things together and you go through hard things together, it really strengthens those partnerships, right? I look back on that first deployment and the people that I deployed with, and we are still connected today, right? It builds these incredible bonds. The key thing, I think, though, is that we're constantly working on building relationships, building trust, building connections, building that partnership, having trust in each other, so that when it comes to the hard thing, when it comes to the really terrifying experience, when it's to the point where you are going to be called on to perform at your highest level, those partnerships, the trust, the connection is already in place.